Okay, there is a reason in terms of why I've started this session off specifically with Gustav Holst. I know it's not a classical music appreciation class, but it does tie in very much with something I'll be talking about as far as C.S. Lewis is concerned, and the particular topic for today's session, which, as you can see there, and as on your modules, is basically portals in mid-century fantasy, with particular focus on C.S. Lewis. Can I just briefly just through a straw poll, obviously 5 out of 17, so it's a reasonable turnout. have you all read The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe?
Yes.
Fantastic, good. That gives us a good sort of grounding to work through that. And I'll come back to why Jupiter, the two we were just hearing from, Holst's Planets Symphony, kind of plays particular relevance in one of the ways in which we can decode and one of the ways in which the Chronicles of Narnia has actually been read and interpreted. Partly tying up with C.S. Lewis's love of medievalism, and in particular his fondness for the cryptic, the line of embedding things in. I mean, most folk will probably be familiar with the interrelationship between the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and the Christian story and so on. And we'll be addressing a number of key things within that as well. As I say, from the perspective of where we are now in 2020, with a new outbreak of bubonic plague and Bring Out the Dead and all sorts of things happening. So who knows what could happen. Maybe we haven't gone too far away from medievalism as perhaps we'd thought. So to start off with, in this first part of the session, I'd like to consider that opening question. How can we actually look in particular at The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe as a science fictional moral allegory? It's a great deal about how science fiction can actually be culturally relevant. It can carry a sort of an importance across the ages. We're living, in, some might say, in a science fictional age, etc. But in particular with respect to this aspect, this element of fantasy that comes through, I want to start addressing how the text actually works. Well, number one, I would suggest, is fundamentally it's about good versus evil, that eternal binary opposition. It's an ideal way of actually decoding something from the point of view of structuralism. You see the positives, you see the triumphal nature of good, but also the challenges that have to be gone through, the journey that has to be explored with respect to obviously coming out to happiness in the end. And that's certainly manifested very much in terms of probably the two diametrically opposed characters of both evil and good, deliberately reversed from that point of view. The White Witch, of course, who we're first introduced to as somebody who encounters the young Edmund and tempts him with Turkish delight and drink, all sorts of other areas, versus, of course, Aslan. And Aslan probably opens up that first notion of how we can actually see how Lewis is pretty much playing around with the text. I don't know if anybody speaks Turkish here, but if you did, the Turkish word for lion is Aslan. Interesting. What other things might be embedded in terms of this character, of how we actually see sort of elements being developed and so on? And again, this coming very much from a scholar of medieval literature, and somebody who himself had actually had a very checkered history. I mean, obviously born in Northern Ireland, lost his mother at a very young age, fought in the First World War, again echoing the kind of pattern that Tolkien actually went through, and it's no surprise that they obviously became firm friends and founded the Inklings as well. Somebody who actually seen not one but two World War conflagrations from that point of view. And just as, in a sense, Tolkien clearly highly influenced in terms of his particular saga by the war that he experienced, I think we can also see there are elements that come across from Lewis as well. Lewis also coming to this initially as a confirmed atheist, at least from his own sort of line. He could not actually sort of acknowledge the existence of God at all, in any way, shape or form, until in essence his time at university began to persuade him, and actually he was finally convinced, yes, there was, and became very much a zealous contributor and writer. I mean, his text, Mere Christianity, which I'll be referring to later, very much addresses the sort of notions of how, from his own perspective, the notion of actually even beginning to consider a universe without a creator, an almighty power, presence, etc., was as ridiculous as actually his former views had actually been. The Reconciliation of Tumnus. Mr. Tumnus. What's not to love? That fawn who's kind of desperately sort of fighting to actually hold his umbrella and his presence under the Narnian lamppost when he first encounters Lucy, obviously the daughter of Eve. And the inner agony he actually goes through in terms of, should he betray her? Should he do as he's told? Should he take that particular line? Or should he effectively sort of say, no, it's okay, you need to go on, etc. The sort of notion that we see within that. I mean, for somebody who's, arguably a relatively mild, minor character in terms of the whole narrative, it's the first example of the second example of the fantastic. The first one being, obviously, the transition, the passage through the wardrobe into the different dimension, the world of Narnia. And then the speaking fawn, this half-man creature that's actually there. Which also ties into the moral quandary of what ought he to do, what should he do? Should he do the right thing? Should he actually sort of do the easy thing? And again, that's very much the heart, in a sense, of Christian religious beliefs. It's not easy. It is a challenge. You know, there are times where you actually think, let's just take the easy road. As M. Scott Peck would say, the road less travelled is often sort of the way to really develop one's particular process. The notions of journeys into the desert and other sort of factors are all part of that. And inevitably, I mentioned earlier, obviously, the first encounter with the White Witch is, of course, the temptation of Edmund. That kind of easy seduction, you know, the easy life, the notion of, oh, you quite, you know, come here, be warm, etc. The sort of the notion that he kind of falls in terms of that, not necessarily through any deliberate malevolent intent on Edmund's part, but it begins to twist, it worms into that whole process of what he should be doing. Another excellent C.S. Lewis text, which is well worth reading, is the Screwtape Letters. Which again is primarily written from the point of view of a whole series of letters written to by Screwtape, who is some kind of character in the evil Hades-like dominions and dwellings, and he writes to his nephew Wormwood about how best to corrupt people. It's Machiavellian in its intensity. It kind of addresses a whole range of ways in which people can effectively be easily manoeuvred off what they believe to be the good path into the path that's anything but good. It's the path that effectively is problematic. It's raising all so many issues in terms of the essence of how people are developing, etc. And we also get, in terms of a sort of research package, the paradigm of betrayal. This whole notion of actually who's being betrayed here. Well, clearly, in the case of Tumnus and Lucy, Lucy is being betrayed and Tumnus is actually betraying. But then actually, in another sense, Edmund also betrays the group by effectively sort of going off to the White Witch after, of course, being finally discovered to being a complete liar. You know, in terms of he had twisted the words round, he actually claimed that Lucy had made it all up. and again the sort of challenge that was faced with respect to that until, of course, all four of the children actually experienced Narnia and they realised that Edmund had actually been lying, etc. So some of those key things are all, again, addressed in some way, shape or form, and they kind of echo through the text. And it's one of the areas where the layers and the ways in which we can work through are kind of being addressed and developed even further. So, there he is. Let's consider not so much death of the author, because obviously he has died, but the notion of 64 years in which Charles Staples Lewis effectively provided a wealth of literature, a huge amount of material that was actually churned out. So we're just covering a smidgen in terms of the sort of things that were today. But again, focusing in terms of his work within medieval history and so on, but also from the point of view of being a children's writer and a science fiction writer, because he actually started writing science fiction before he developed the Narnia thing. And also somebody who was fond of the cryptic. I mean, he married Joy Gresham without telling any of his colleagues. You know, basically didn't even know he's married, basically kept it a secret for quite some time before he actually sort of revealed from that point of view. In one of our kind of history's quirks of fate, he actually died on the same day that President Kennedy was assassinated and the Beatles had their first number one album. It was interesting, sort of kind of connection between the two things, but again, interesting in terms of that. And he never liked the phrase, or he never liked the names Clive Staples, he preferred to be known as Jack. You know, that was his catchphrase, that was the preferred name that people would refer to him. And as was often said, he didn't really look necessarily like a scholar. His persona was almost that of the butcher. The sort of friendly, jovial, come back to Jupiter again in a few moments, words in which he sort of perceived as somebody who is the avuncular person. There's another adjective that can be used, the kindly uncle. It's interesting when we see the character of Professor Kirk in Narnia, who, of course, he introduces us to later on in the seven-book series in The Magician's Nephew, when we see that the magician's nephew is actually Kirk, who basically becomes the owner of the house. And, of course, the wood of the sacred tree in The Magician's Nephew. Has anybody read The Magician's Nephew? Yes, right? The wood of that is actually, it serves as the basis for the wardrobe itself, so the kind of interconnectivity within that in terms of the origin story and again the creation of Narnia from the breath of Aslan as well, kind of carrying with it that kind of mythological Genesis type opening within the whole sort of sequence. So you could say that long before George Lucas decided to do the prequels with respect to The Force Awakens, etc., Lewis had kind of got there ahead of it. And it's also no surprise really that J.K. Rowling has admitted she's a huge fan of the Narnia series, because you can see other elements developed within that whole field. And yet, critics would turn around and say, yeah, but Narnia is more of a hodgepodge. I mean, it's got Father Christmas in. It's got fauns in. It's got everything in. I mean, the movie actually has polar bears and all sorts of things from it. Isn't it a case of, you know, almost a postmodern sort of aspect of things? Well, maybe, but maybe there's more of a structure, more of a rationale for that, as I'll hopefully look to explore and develop over the session. Lewis was once described as being a man in love with the imagination. Thinking is the best way to travel. One of the great things about all books, all texts and so on, is that they do open portals in themselves. Just the very act of opening a book, electronic or otherwise, can raise that whole issue in terms of where we develop what we see with respect to our experiences, etc. And although there's no logical proof for alternate dimensions, the notion that in one reality, I and everybody in this room is a figure of fiction, simply saying or carrying out the things that an author is writing for us to do, philosophical sort of point that's often been said in terms of the universe simply being a dream, what happens when the dreamer awakes, or are we the dreamer, and so on. But it's still a fascinating element of actually discussing and addressing the whole notion of what do we mean by alternate dimensions. Alt history is a very popular phrase. Philip K. Dick has written extensively. In fact, Man in the High Castle is based primarily on alternate history. What would happen if the Nazis actually had won the Second World War, etc. So this kind of works through that. And of course, we see manifested in the text at the end that despite King Peter, King Edmund, Queen Lucy, Queen Susan, living a full lifetime in Narnia, ultimately just seconds have gone by when they return to normal Earth time. I don't know if anybody's followed the Star Trek series, Picard, or if you ever want to go back to Star Trek The Next Generation, but there is an episode which you can access called The Inner Light, in which Picard effectively experiences an entire life, literally in about 3 or 4 minutes. It was zapped with an alien sort of system, and that whole notion of, what do we refer to as time? You know, we are time travellers. One of the things that I start off, if you choose to do the science fiction module next year, or electives of that, we talk about worlds and time travel, one of the key things. But we all travel further in time. We all travel forward in time. And yet, you know, it is this notion that it's beyond time. It's a kind of artifice that we sort of work within and so on. And Narnia is existing as this experience, this dimension beyond the sort of known. And of course, when we mention time, and clearly the subtlety is actually there in three of those things, we come across some of the influences that occur. That one probably being the most blatant take in the Stephen Moffat era of Doctor Who, the Doctor, the Widow and the Wardrobe, which again, it's worth looking at just to see how the sort of Lewis influence is permeating and working through in a number of other key areas and so on. I mean, you could arguably say that the Professor kind of has a kind of analogue in the Doctor, whatever she or he is sort of based at in terms of the Edwardian line and the sort of connection that works within that and the travelling in time and space and dimensions. And clearly it's bigger on the inside than on the outside. That dimensional transcendentality is writ large in terms of the wardrobe itself. You know, the whole sort of notion of going through the wardrobe. And of course other ways into Narnia. You know, there are other sort of aspects that are developed within that whole field of how people travel and so on. So, can we then go on to say that what Lewis is also providing for us here, given that the first book in the seven book series was written in 1950, was primarily a post-Christian viewpoint? Was it something which, again, you don't have to be, you don't have to have any knowledge at all of the Christian message to appreciate what we get within The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Sometimes it can help, sometimes it can't, etc. But is it also very British? Is it a notion of speculative fiction which, in a sense, kind of focuses very much on is there honey still for tea, you know, in terms of the characters that we see developed and so on? And some of the areas to maybe consider within that are the fact that when it was written, rationing was still in place. You know, rationing didn't actually end until 1954, 53-54. We were still actually ruled over by a monarch, pre-Queen Elizabeth II, of course. The aftermath of World War II was still impacting on the whole system. I mean, the whole aspect of the Pevensies being evacuated and sent into another area. I mean, the line that's actually made in the movie that, you know, they were sent to escape war, not to actually take part in a war, was very much to the fore of that. And I've mentioned obviously the connection with Tolkien and the other inklings at Oxford in terms of the conglomeration of folk who effectively wanted to actually read their kind of fiction to each other. So they were basically being criticised and really kind of quite vigorously criticised. I mean, Tolkien, make no secret of the fact, he hated The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Literally did not like it at all. Really found it not offensive, but actually just as I said, hodgepodge. It was a combination of all sorts of things that seemed to be thrown in there without any kind of real rationale why, whereas Tolkien clearly, when he's writing his whole Middle Earth materials, I'm sure you've covered, very much creating language, creating a whole world building, developing that whole structure. And it seemed as though, well, all Lewis has basically done is you go through Wardrobe, bang, there's Narnia, you know, bish bosh bash, end of, move on. Maybe that's, again, probably what we're here to address and so on. Certainly, as I mentioned, because of his own personal journey, his own journey of faith, and actually sort of addressing that, there are clear signs that he wished to actually use it to a certain extent as a notion of expressing what exactly Christianity was. I mean, the book that he produced called Mere Christianity, which is a compilation of his radio pieces that he gave for BBC Radio, very much addressed the fact at the end of it all, after taking you through a very interesting philosophical notion of how materialism and idealism and realism also sort of maintains a sort of aspect and that holds on society. Ultimately, maybe there is something that actually just leads to not being a great individual, but actually partly a human character who's experiencing this whole notion of Christianity. And Christianity as a philosophy of life, a way of living, a way which ultimately says, be kind to each other. A way which actually kind of addresses those sort of notions, which has often been corrupted, often been changed, often been adjusted in so many ways, but still fundamentally works on that basis. And given that 2,000 years ago, Christ himself had used the parable in terms of working through that, why is it any surprise that Lewis should also use a parable, a narrative, to start getting those messages across? Whether it's the resurrection, whether it's the notion of life after death, whether it's a notion of the creation, philosophy, evolutionary, any of those sort of aspects. I mean, it's one of those areas where I think one of the lines that Tolkien actually said is, surely, in the case of Aslan, if he is the Christ character, then if you're going to be intrinsically true to that, it should be Father Aslanmas as opposed to Father Christmas, because you're making an assumption that actually people know it's Father Christmas. How could they know this when there's kind of no Christ identity in terms of Narnia that we're aware of? That was just one of the sort of criticisms in terms of the inner logic being apparently skewed. But again, I'll hopefully sort of address that in a few moments. One of the challenges that's often put forward in terms of Christianity is, yeah, at the end of the day, the main character, the Son of God, is nailed to a cross, and that's it, end of story. Why? Why did he do it? Why did they do it? Why was that sort of there? And it's that kind of really challenging juxtaposition of the agony and the ecstasy, to quote sort of the Michelangelo painting the Sistine Chapel. It's the notion of, as Lewis himself says, people who have not been in Narnia sometimes think that thing cannot be good and terrible at the same time. It's the sense that actually on one level you are reconciling good and evil, Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. And they're not seen as mutually exclusive, but they're seen as seeing as being essentially occurring simultaneously, which is why I use that sort of slide, the Christian paradox, in terms of how we see that being developed, manifested, and so on. And that was also writ large in terms of what we see here. You know, how can Aslan go from being this huge, powerful being to effectively, on the basis of the sacrifice for Edmund and to ensure that Edmund is rescued from his evil ways and from being a prisoner of the White Witch, Aslan effectively goes back to deep magic and sacrifices himself and goes through the humiliation of the crown of thorns, the shaving, the whole sort of aspect of that before effectively even deeper magic manifests and again he resurrects himself from that point of view. Again, the weeping and the wailing and the challenges of Lucy and Susan suddenly actually translates into a full joyous occasion. You know, the cover of the text in terms of the line, the Witch of the Wardrobe, that we see the sort of the connectivity between Aslan and Susan and Lucy when the resurrection has actually occurred, and so on. You know, you've got those two things. It's the worst of times, it's the best of times, to use the whole notion of Dickens and Tale of Two Cities. You know, how do you actually sort of work through that? On the one hand, everything is fantastic, everything is disastrous. Where do you actually pitch that? How do you begin to start reconciling that with what would seem to be logic and so on and so forth? And it's a big sort of ask that sort of is being made from that point of view. This is where you also get the Lewis love of mythology coming through. Mythology that echoes in a whole variety of aspects, whether they be naiads or water creatures, dryads, or indeed other nymphs and aspects of that, centaurs, or indeed werewolves that are sort of seen. They're all characters that begin to emerge in this. Now, on the one hand, from the point of view of seeing this huge panorama, this huge spectacle of all of these activities, it's really opening up a range of storytelling that is it's pretty profound. And again, obviously I mentioned Rowling obviously makes good use of it. I thought I'd leave out the werewolves there, but basically in terms of the sort of ways in which you see the fundamental elements that come across. Now these also, earth, air, fire and water, are also back in terms of the ways in which we see how things operate, how things develop, etc. And I want to take a few moments now to just actually give you a short little piece which opens up another sort of aspect in terms of views of Lewis as well. So let's have this.
Lewis had the ability to touch universal human experience. And I think the Chronicles of Narnia characterize that. You see that. So I think whether one has Christian persuasions or does not have Christian persuasions, the book speaks. The book, you can come and maybe not have any idea that there's anything Christian about them at all, but come away touched, come away enriched as a human being for having traveled through those stories.
I think Lewis was aware that you'll lose people's attention and you'll turn some people off if I'm bringing in Christianity. And so many of these things, like the Narnian stories, are not overtly Christian at all.
The most popular of Lewis's fictional works is the children's book series called The Chronicles of Narnia. Like Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, Narnia takes us into a world of myth and imagination with an underlying message that some people believe parallels the story of Christ.
You appeal to our sense of right and wrong. Now, we may not accept the Christian conception of right and wrong, but he can bring that over into this parallel world where we don't have prejudices, and we cheer. Tolkien did the same thing. Says he basically takes, you know, this world and he sort of plays it out in this parallel world of Middle Earth, and we're all on board and we're all cheering for the right things, and awakens these things within us. And I think that's what Lewis is doing as well, and he did it intentionally.
I think Lewis and Tolkien were effective in competition, but I think he was rather more from Tolkien's side. Certainly, when he read The Land, the Witch and the Wardrobe, he thought it was awful stuff. And Lewis would never have put all those things in there, such as nymphs and satyrs and Father Christmas. And it was mixing mythology in the most preposterous way. But they're very different writers. Lewis was not fundamentally concerned with the past in the way that Tolkien was.
And yet there is a commonality between them, which is the shared depth of understanding of language. If you build an arch, a Gothic arch, for example, every stone is an essential key part of that arch, and the arch simply won't work without it. Both the Lord of the Rings and the Narnian Chronicles are built in that way.
In the first book Lewis wrote in the Chronicles of Narnia series, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, four siblings climb through a wardrobe in the house of old Professor Kirk and find themselves in the mythical land of Narnia. They encounter an evil witch and a powerful but loving lion named Aslan.
Separate from ours. Lewis operates in his narrative by a process of what I might call displacement. So what assumptions you make about something are continually being undercut.
I suppose they would fall in the genre of fairy tales in one sense. Timeline of our world of children from our world keep going to Narnia and coming back and having fantastic and fascinating adventures with all sorts of interesting characters, fauns and centaurs, and the animals of this of Narnia are gifted with speech and thought.
Well, I think the Lothar way of showing them what we take for granted is extraordinary, and the extraordinariness is realised in Narnia. But he has a sense of ceremony and hierarchy as being part of the everlasting nature of the world, that everyone finds themselves in one proper place, even though one may meet across them. And so that's part of it. He writes hierarchically in style because that's the cast of his mind.
Lewis saw life in epic proportions, and we don't. That we're engaged in something much bigger than ourselves. And the issues are real, and people are real, and the world in which we live in was created by a personal God who was incredibly creative, and this world is enchanted.
There's tension, there's intrigue, there's battles for good and evil there, and the kinds of things that we're really caught up in this world. People, human beings, are having to make difficult choices. When they do, they have consequences. And this, it's put in a context that even children can understand, but adults are enthralled.
What's important is the principle. The principle of joy versus the principle of abnegation, if we can even dignify the word principle. The current of innocence versus the poison of defamation and desecration.
A lot of people think that the Narnian Chronicles are allegories, but they're not, because there's not an exact one-to-one relationship. You know, Aslan is a Christ-like figure, but he's not exactly like Christ. The witch is like the evil one, but not exactly.
The wardrobe in the Lion, which the wardrobe is a symbol of enclosure, and the children coming out into a new country is in a sense... It is a way of going into the soul, actually. But I think the land, Narnia is the landscape of the spirit, to some degree. But it is certainly a way of going out of the self.
This is what Lewis called a supposal. Suppose there were a world like Narnia. Suppose it had animals in it. Suppose God wanted to redeem that world like he has ours. Then suppose he had his son become a lion, as he did in this world, but becoming a man. You are with Aslan, you hear him, you have adventures, the children ride on his back, and yet you might be with him, and taking it all in, and only later, long after you read the books, do you realize, I've met that same character in the real world. And when we call him Jesus.
Which is an interesting perception on the notion of multi-layered, multi-faceted universes and elements as well. And I thought a couple of the points that came out of that, again, you can watch it, I think it's on Amazon Prime in terms of the documentary side of things, is that it starts addressing the notion of Lewis not necessarily writing it as a complete allegory, writing something which clearly had parallels, but they were sort of parallels. They were supposals. They were saying ultimately that classic science fiction aspect, what would happen if? But he also goes on to talk about this whole notion of the broader world, and the journey into the soul. There is a sense that certainly Michael Moorcock and Brian Aldiss and Ballard certainly write about, where they start talking about real science fiction works not when you're travelling into outer space, but you start travelling into inner space. And the journey inside is often as significant and important as that that we see manifest outside. And that's, again, a constant, whether you're doing a spirit animal search in the case of Native Americans or Native Australians or so on, or whether you're actually looking for a particular spirit quest, etc., to find that meaning in life and purpose within the whole sequence. And it does relate to that whole sense that on one level, we've kind of lost something. But on the other hand, maybe we've also gained something as well, because in the apparent chaos of things that are being manifested, etc., we see new life being manifested. We see the reason that good conquers evil, that Aslan wins out over the witch, and also indeed in the final battle, arguably, is because you have that deeper magic, that there is another layer, another line before everything existed, before even time in itself existed and worked through that. And we see that, again, seen, as Lewis does, as the ultimate triumph, whether we are believed to be living in the end times or the apocalyptic era or whatever, that ultimately there will be a triumphant resolution, that things will work out okay in the end, that despite how darkest it might appear to be, there will be light shining through ultimately within that whole process. So let's go back to this figure that obviously emerges at a time where the Beavers are on the run with the three Pevensey children, Edmund having gone off to the White Witch, and effectively they're racing to get to Aslan, and they're not sure in terms of they hear sleigh bells, and suddenly it's Father Christmas who has gifts and things to develop this. And I'm sure that I probably won't be alone, and there are many people who actually found it a little anomalous to see this character that, certainly in terms of the image we see in the book, you could say, yeah, isn't that just a concoction of a fizzy drink manufacturer in the United States in the 1920s, in terms of the image that we actually have of this jolly, white-bearded, red-clad man, etc.? Does it have its roots back in St. Nicholas? How do we develop that? How does it also connect together from that? But it also ties into that tune I started off with at the start, which is Jupiter. Jupiter in terms of the spirit of joviality, and indeed taken from C.S. Lewis's own poem, The Planets, which he wrote in 1935, 15 years before the Narnian quests were even written, actually starts addressing the whole impact of various characteristics of the planets. I'll just read you the actual thing from this point of view. Move with music, measureless the waves. Joy and jubilee, it is Jove's orbit, filled and festal, faster turning with arc ampler. From the lakes of Tintirian traders, in trouble steering, came with his cargoes the Cornish treasure that his ray ripens, of wrath ended and woes mended, of winter past and guilt forgiven. And good fortune, Jove is master, and of jocund revel. Laughter of ladies, the lion-hearted, the myriad-minded, men like the gods, helps and heroes, helms of nations, just and gentle, are Jove's children. Just a short excerpt there. I mean, the full text is not quite rhyme with the Ancient Mariner length, but it is a substantial poem that he actually wrote in 1935. And it has also been picked up in terms of the Narnia Code. The fact that if you start seeing the whole text as being analogous and carrying with the other messages, we then start beginning to understand how this is working, how this is coming together. Fantasies, love maps. Next week you're focusing on Ursula K. Le Guin. You know, one of the key aspects with the Earthsea era and the character of Ged and so on is the whole notion of the map, the archipelago of islands that you get in Earthsea and so on. And just as we saw in the video clip there, Narnia itself is a creation. It's interesting that the map is something that Baudrillard refers to in terms of the whole postmodern sort of aspects, that in Simula and Simulacrum, he sees the symbol of the map as being somehow resonant with what he would maintain is the postmodern world in which we live in. In which we effectively are adrift in a sea of virtual symbols, you know, seeking meaning and giving meaning to all sorts of other areas and elements. I mean, that's part of the fun. It's one of the joys of doing a humanities degree and areas within that. But it's also a way of powering through that whole aspect of how we start working through that. So let's talk not about Seven of Nine, although that's an interesting character from Picard, Voyager, and so on. But the concept of seven in terms of how it relates to Lewis's experiences. 7 days in the week. Why are there 7 days in the week? Well, they're named after seven particular heavenly spheres. People talk about being in seventh heaven, actually transcending the whole notions. And this also comes across from the notion of the pre-Copernican era. I just picked out those five words there from the short excerpt I read about Jupiter. Because you could argue that if you were to put together a five-word summary of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, those five words would be it. Winter past and guilt forgiven. Winter's over, spring's come, all's well with the world, and all guilts have been forgiven, or sins have been forgiven. That's the ultimate sort of line that you actually got there. Of course, there's the Magnificent Seven as well, Seven Samurai. There are lots of sort of sevens that we can actually start working through that process. But in an era pre-Nicholas Copernicus, where, in terms of medieval era, the medieval worldview was very much that the Earth was the centre of everything. We were at the heart of the whole thing. The sun would go around the Earth, and the other celestial bodies that we could see as well would also impact. Anybody know where the term, what sort of term in which we regularly use this these days, which refers to the influence of the planets on us, actually emerges from? It's Italian doctors who, when you actually had a head cold or coronavirus, I don't know, whatever, back in the day, bring out your dead. Don't worry, I think we're all clear today, so mind you, 5 out of 17 is going to be just cutting through the whole course. Can't, all gone now, precisely. But in terms of that, the whole notion of being influenced by the planets in terms of malevolence would be influenza, if you were Italian. Influenza. That's where the flu actually comes from, so the influenza aspect from that point of view. So there was very much, not in a kind of astrologically eccentric way, but in a sense that somehow the bodies of the planets did have an impact in terms of what we see on the Earth. I mean, obviously the moon with respect to the tides, the sun with respect to crops and so on. And at that particular stage, the only visible planetary bodies were Mars, Venus, Jupiter and Saturn from that point of view. So again, they're all interconnecting in terms of that process. And there is a huge sea change that occurs before Nicholas Copernicus, the Polish astronomer, effectively came up with this thought of saying that maybe the Earth goes around the Sun in 1543, and after 1543, when On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Spheres was actually produced and printed and distributed. This, of course, coming a little bit after the 1475 invention of the Gutenberg printing press. So you're seeing a distinct sort of shift here. And equally, the reason I'm actually introducing this is exactly the century that Lewis has specialised in terms of academic. It's what he's really been, that's what he learns his living with at Oxford. That's what he actually does in terms of teaching medieval history in areas within that whole field. So there is a sense, of course, of permanence, a sense of solidarity, and a sense of, you know, people knew their place, everybody knew their place, and things were sorted out. The hierarchical structure that we see mentioned in the sort of text within that. And of course, seven heavenly bodies, seven heavenly planets from that sort of point of view, including the Earth, you've actually got seven texts within that. Now, if you start beginning to translate the notion of the character of Jupiter as being resonant with the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and maybe the Sun connecting with the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Mercury connecting with the Silver Chair, Mars, the Bringer of War, connecting with Prince Caspian, the Return to Narnia, the battle from that point of view, you get a slightly different take in terms of how these things are being developed and so on. Because what Lewis is then actually doing is he's weaving in more medieval cultural relevancies to this particular tale, which is also writ large with texts relating to Christianity and so on and so forth. And in that sort of instance, the incarnation of a Christ-like figure in terms of Aslan and apostles or indeed disciples and so on tends to kind of coalesce a little bit more effectively than just saying, well, it seems as though it's randomly selected a whole different range of things that have been put together to, you know, effectively just think, because it seemed a good idea at the time. Let's consider six possible sort of areas that you can also start unpicking this particular text from. And we haven't really spoken too much about Peter, Edmund, Susan and Lucy. I always used to think they were a bit too goody-two-shoes, even Edmund to a certain extent. They seemed to be very, very middle class. Very, but then, actually, okay, maybe they were representative of a certain kind of Britishness at a certain time and a certain period and so on. Either way, it's interesting that the only one who really falls... Well, first of all, they all go back for Prince Caspian, but then for the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, it's really only Lucy, Edmund, and of course there's another additional soul who actually also goes through his challenging journey, etc. And they all, of course, return for the final battle, except Susan. She's one of the king's queens and of Narnia, who effectively sort of moves on from that perspective. We've talked extensively about Christmas being there, Christmas past. Obviously Dickens wrote about Scrooge and Christmas present, etc., and the whole essence of Christmas and that sense of, you know, put Christ back into Christmas. Mary, mind, what's about? Is it the Feast of Saturnalia? Was it simply appropriated by the Christians to, you know, develop another sort of aspect of the whole thing? But fundamentally, there is a moment, and that notion of the winter solstice being the time in December of the longest night and the shortest day, comprised, of course, with the midsummer of the longest day and the shortest night and so on. And that experience that you actually have, which if you're looking at celestial bodies, if you're seeing how those things are being developed and evolved, you inevitably will start coming around to the notion of, well, maybe there are things, more things in heaven and earth that are dreamt of in our poor philosophy Horatio, as the bard Shakespeare was fond of actually sort of alluding to from that point of view. Also, we see something in terms of, as you saw with the wondrousness of nature, which I'm sure even Greta Thunberg would find quite fascinating. Interesting pop fact. Greta Thunberg shares her birthday with J.R.R. Tolkien and myself on the 3rd of January. Strange, isn't it? So there we are, anyway. What went wrong? I don't know. But in terms of... It's just... Where do we go to in terms of those sort of aspects? But the ecology of Narnia. The sense of... a time initially frozen in winter, where it's always winter and never Christmas, so there's never any sense of relief. It's interesting that one of the criticisms about the Disney film that was produced, they'd originally intended to make all seven, but at the end of the day, after Voyage of the Dawn Treader, it wasn't making the kind of finances that they had hoped it would. And I think we did have this challenge that maybe the wintry scenes were too nice. Maybe they were portrayed as too sort of storybookish, that maybe, you know, when we see Mr. Tumnus, he should be really battling against the elements. Because it's not a pleasant place. If it's icy cold, if it's constantly sort of, you know, full of snow, if you're fighting against the elements, etc. And how do you shift from that? Again, beyond the remit of this particular thing, but if you're interested in terms of planetary ecologies, certainly Brian Aldiss's Heliconia trilogy, Heliconia Spring, Heliconia Summer, and Heliconia Winter, which deals with a planet which basically spends thousands of years in a particular ecology, in a particular sort of season. It's quite fascinating from that. And it also starts addressing, as I say, this notion of what Gilbert Ryle, the philosopher again of the 20th century, would refer to as the mind-body relationship. You know, how much of this, as I say, is literally, as we saw in the video clip there, C.S. Lewis engaging in a classic philosophical approach of the supposal. What would happen if? You know, one of the things that certainly science fiction often sort of says, and fantasy as well to that point, is what would happen if? How you actually generate that particular aspect? And how do you actually relate those particular elements to what we're seeing and so on? Is time ultimately a partner that we actually will travel alongside us, that we kind of can remember the sort of person we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever, and we kind of intrinsically know that, but ultimately in many ways we are not the same individual. We have changed, we have developed, we have become more hardened. You know, we've become hardened by battle, by time, etc. That's one of the key things in terms of the development that the children actually go through. Peter gets the sword, Lucy gets the tincture, Susan gets the horn. You know, the whole sort of the gifts, the importance that come through from that point of view. And fundamentally, in the beginning was the Word, of course, the biblical allusion, that power of the Word. Something which, again, no spoilers for next week, but in terms of what I'm sure you'll be covering with Ursula K. Le Guin, is that whole nature of the Word and the significance of how much power she puts in the naming of things. The character of Sparrowhawk, the way in which that, you know, opens up a whole new area. The fact that it is to know a person's details, name, contact, provides you with a sense of power and illusion over that. I mean, the sons and daughters of Eve, or Adam, you know, sons, daughters of Eve, sons of Adam, the sort of areas that come through from that. The biblical sort of illusion that comes back to that whole process of, you know, the Bible and so on. Something else that is worth considering is this little map I put together in terms of the relationship between materialism, i.e. things where you can physically see what's happening, where you can almost use Newton mechanics to actually say, I know that this is so because I can sense it's actually so, and also the sort of areas that maybe Lewis mourned we kind of lost. Because using a scientific method has got lots of positive aspects to it. But whilst focusing on the natural sciences devolving in terms of, you see there, in terms of what we call the hard sciences, you would also lose a number of key things relating to certainly astrology and the interrelationship between, often confused with astronomy, completely different astronomy, very much dealing with observation of celestial bodies, yes, but not the influence that those bodies might actually have. And certainly by no means predicting the future that astrology sort of connects from that point of view onwards. Phlogiston theory, which is the notion that there are humours and things sort of built up and things that sort of are adjusted within that, and of course folk psychology. All of those, in terms of the creationist sort of believers, would say no, they've all gone from that point of view, and we have a scientific, rational way forward. Which is fine, but maybe it also takes away some of the colour, some of the dynamism of everyday experiences within that as well. Or maybe it doesn't, that's open for debate. Maybe you can come to that little line, which I thought was quite interesting. You know, ultimately what you've got is, as Nietzsche would say, the death of God, because God, or the constant notion of a divine force, etc., is problematical. I mean, Krishnamurti, a gentleman I'm particularly fond of, because he actually believed very much in what we'll be doing in the next part of the session, which is education by dialogue. Sort of finding out what sort of people's views are with respect to that and getting that sort of third, almost synergistic sort of line forward. Is this whole essence of how does the mind create things? You think of all the battles and wars that have been waged in terms of religion. You think of the kind of passions that religion has set up and orchestrated. Fundamentally opposed to what either Islam or the Quran or the Bible would actually sort of ever maintain was their core message, and yet the corruption of the core message, the development within that, in many ways the same kind of corruption that Lewis is talking about in terms of how Edmund is corrupted in terms of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and how one needs to be vigilant, one needs to maintain one's sensibilities, otherwise who knows what could actually sort of be the end result, and so on. Or maybe it wouldn't be pleasant. Obviously, I've taken this from the actual movie itself. So again, sort of it echoed the whole sort of thing through. But again, there is that sense of exploration. Arguably, the sort of notion of where one emerges into a new world, taking those first footsteps into the other dimension, the dimension of Narnia, the land of Narnia, and what wonders they would see there. Yes, there's fear. Yes, there's apprehension. Yes, there's concern. But ultimately, the rewards are far more significant. And again, the way in which they head through... I mean, Lucy, the youngest, first of all, has the experience. Then it's the second youngest, Edmund, who, as we said, effectively discovers the land realizes that the thing is actually true, but then refuses to acknowledge that, and then finally, in a sense, almost the maternal patriarchal substitutes, because they are the elder children, Susan and Peter, effectively sort of brought on board to see that. You've also, you know, in one sense, you've almost got a kind of cipher for the nuclear family. You know, all you need is, you know, to have, if you have 2.4 children, you connect on that basis in terms of the traditional sort of notion as gender balanced and so on. 2005, 15 years ago since it actually sort of launched as a movie, but lots of other areas coming through that, and the fact that we're still talking about Lewis today, the fact that over 700,000 copies of his books are sold on an annual basis, etc., kind of suggests that there is a cultural legacy that sort of manifested in, even if you haven't actually seen that, the very notion of the term Narnia, and Narnian in the areas of the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, without even necessarily being aware of some of the allusions and elements that come into that, whether it be the planets, whether it be Jupiter, or whatever. Interestingly enough, Michael Ward is the scholar who's most credited with that discovery that I referred to there in terms of C.S. Lewis's poem, The Planets, and Lewis's being heavily influenced by Gustav Holst's music for The Planets, and indirectly his notion of why, in terms of the number seven, he was very keen for the medievalism to actually come across within that. And there's a very extensive text called, as you can see there, Planet Narnia, which talks about the Narnian code as well. You can also get it, again, on Amazon for about £4 or £5, the Narnian code. It's not to be confused with the Da Vinci Code, which is a whole new fantasy world, which I'm sure we can actually go into in various other sort of ways in terms of how address the sort of thing about. Michael Ward is very much a Lewis scholar and works that. It's fair to say that there are a number of academics who disagree with him. They say that, again, he's also trying to be a bit too glib in terms of addressing the sort of areas. And, of course, given that Lewis passed away in 1964, we don't really know his own views on that. And what we have got, though, is the lines of, you know, his liking for, not obfuscation, but actually burying golden nuggets in the text to open up and discuss and address a number of other key areas as well. And if you're looking to some of the echoes of some of Lewis's beliefs and his views with respect to that, those three in particular, I would say, are well worth accessing. Lewis is a relatively easy read. He doesn't write, it's not like Spinoza's Ethics, if you want to sort of really sort of, or Wittgenstein's views on the whole thing. But all of those things, I mean, I would say start off with Screwtape Letters and Mere Christianity and then possibly The Problem of Pain. In a sense, his own life, as I said, mirroring the challenges that he was faced with, losing his mother and losing his father, fighting in the First World War, losing friends and comrades there, finally meeting at a very late stage in his life, actually, certainly well into middle age, the woman, the divorced woman he eventually married, and then they died literally within months of each other in sort of 6 inches. Obviously, if you've ever seen the movie Shadowlands, you see Anthony Hopkins sort of opened up a whole range of things there, which is very difficult to actually watch that without shedding a tear, you know, whatever you're sort of feeling at the end. So he had a range of sort of elements within that, but those were the sort of key aspects that I would say probably sort of relate to what I wanted to address today. So, the next stage is